Right. Well, this time last week, I was walking on a beautiful beach, and it is so good to be back with you. But actually, I know you're not supposed to tell lies in Sunday school, but actually, it is good to be back with you. At any rate, like I say, it was good to have a little break, good to go to the beach, spend some time with a lot of extended family. Those of you who know me know I love to walk on the beach, so it's one of life's great pleasures. And you can walk and walk and walk, and then you realize that you have to take every step back that you started. And that's kind of like how our lesson is today. But it's a very short lesson in a way, but there's a lot to it. It's C.S. Lewis, in terms of his methodology, is sort of taking a big turn at this point. It's a lot like closing the hinge on a door. So I hope that you are reading along. You will see that we are launching this week into book three. Book one was, you can tell a lot of these chapters and books just by their heading. I was working through the table of contents this morning. Sometimes that's a useful exercise. Book one, Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. That was, you will recall, the book in which Lewis observed that there is most assuredly an unwritten law of human nature by which we as humans try to align and regulate and value and characterize human behavior. It's something we have in our heart. It's something that we are born with, something that the ancient Romans and the Greeks called natural law, something that you're born with, something that Thomas Jefferson wrote that we are endowed with by our creator. Very old concept. We observed in book one that even those who deny the existence of such a law actually live by such a law. They live by it, and they most assuredly expect others to live by it. So C.S. Lewis dealt in book one with the existence of this moral law or this natural law, this shared sense of right and wrong, and what is good behavior, what is bad behavior, what's fair, what's unfair. All of these concepts are concepts that we're born with and that are shared universally. In book two, Lewis focused on what Christians believe and why they believe it. By implication, book two also focuses on what Christians do not believe, that which we reject and why we must reject it as Christians. Book three focuses on Christian behavior. So at book three, Lewis takes what has been unpacked and unfolded for us in books one and two and basically asks, how should it make a difference in our lives? And again, he asks that great persistent question, why? 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 It really underscores everything that he writes in this book. It runs through Mere Christianity. It's the central inquiry of the book. The single word question that's another thing that we're born knowing how to ask is why. If you have children, you know that to be true. They are very good at asking why. But Lewis asks basically, why do we have this law? Why do we know it exists? Why are we bound by it? Why do we expect others to live by it? Why must we know that it comes from some being outside of ourselves? Why can it not be from within ourselves, something that we thought up on our own? And then today he asks the question, why must it make a difference in our lives and how we organize and lead our lives? At any rate, why be Christians? Why does the Christian view make sense? Why must it exclusively make sense? Those are all questions that as I was getting ready for today, I thought have really been dealt with and are sort of being boiled down and condensed at this point. In book three, we're going to be focusing on three chapters, as John observed, 1 and 8 this week, and next week, 10. I do urge you to read the other chapters, and I'm just going to give you again the chapter headings. you'll kind of pick up on why they're important. We're not glossing over things because they're unimportant. We're moving quickly because of time and because of time constraints. But today, as I said, we're going to be looking at the three parts of morality, and then we're going to be looking at 8, which is the great sin. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that when John gets to you in just a moment. But in between 1 and 8, if you're reading along, are things such as social morality, morality and psychoanalysis, sexual morality, Christian marriage, forgiveness. Things that we will not be able to talk about because of time constraints in book 3, or chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12. So we're going to, and those specifically are charity, hope, faith, and faith. That's how they're headed anyway. But we will try to work in as much of the material from these other chapters in chapters 1 and 8 and 10 as well. So today we've taken chapters 1, we've taken chapters 8, and we boil them down under the heading. This will tell you where we're headed today: Christian behavior and the great sin of pride. How do some, especially non-Christians, but quite a few Christians too, characterize God? Grace does an exercise with the children in their confirmation classes where they pick out images of Jesus that are familiar to them, and it's everything from what she calls Jesus's, and this is Grace saying this, Jesus's senior picture, which is the more familiar Jesus, the wearing the robe, to Jesus in an operating room, to Jesus standing beside a gurney at the scene of a wreck, to Jesus being in a jail cell. But a lot of people conceptualize God and characterize him the way Lewis mentions right here at the start. And I'm quoting. He says, he being God, is the sort of person who is always snooping around to see if anyone is enjoying himself and then trying to stop it. Okay? That is how many view Christian morality. It stems from a God who is snooping around, making sure no one is having too much fun, and them trying to stop it. If you go with this view, then you probably take the next logical step, and that is morality, which we're talking about today, is a way to somehow limit happiness. You don't want too much of that happiness thing. Morality is a way of limiting happiness, according to this view. And so we are really kind of back to that great moral law that Lewis mentioned in the very first chapter, the first sentence of the first chapter, when he asked us to imagine two people arguing and appealing to a common standard of behavior. And now he's saying, what is the purpose of this standard of behavior? Is it to keep us from having too much fun, that God somehow rations out the fun, rations out the pleasure, and is there to make sure we don't have too much of it? And the moral law is there for that reason. It may not be a surprise to you, but Lewis rejects that view, and so should you, according to what he writes in this book. He says that the moral law is not there to limit happiness. It's not there to prevent happiness, but instead it is there to promote it. And he compares the moral law to a set of rules for a finely tuned human machine. They make the machine work better. And that's why we have this moral law that stems from outside of us, that comes to us from God. I made a note in my own margin that the moral law is a lot like an owner's manual. If you try driving your car, or in my case, my truck, without an owner's manual, you get into problems in a hurry. So the moral law is not there to limit us or to somehow circumscribe us, but it's there to make sure that we are who we should be, and that the machine that we are functions as it should. Lewis says that a lot of people go around talking about morality and idealism, and they sort of mingle those two concepts. And that's something that we do as well. But he says it really doesn't mean that much when we talk about somebody having high ideals. As he says that one who is of high ideals may only tell a few lies instead of lots of lies, or may be just engaged in a little bit of adultery instead of a lot of it. And those are the examples that he uses. So he says that we don't need to think of ideals, that instead, let's think about morality for what it is, which is a set of rules and a set of limitations, rather than a set of ideals. He also points out that if you reduce it to being just a matter of high ideals and idealism, basically it's sort of like doing a mathematical proof. Did any of you have to do proofs on the bulletin board? Okay, I never figured out how to do proofs, so or outline sentences for that matter. But I will tell you that if you go off on the sum just a little ways, you're off all the way through. And so he likens morality to being a set of rules, almost like mathematics, where there's a right way and a wrong way at each sequence of the logic and at each step of the logic that you're following. Now, he then carries the reasoning a step further. And John, I'm going to talk very fast, okay, from this point on. But he says that there are two ways, and I'm relying pretty heavily on my book because I found in taking notes that, and some of you may have had this problem too, I think I've had people mention it, if you start to outline and start to underline, you're pretty soon you find yourself writing down everything that C.S. Lewis said. And so it sort of defeats that purpose of outlining. But at any rate, I'm just going to rely on the book, and I'm looking at page 70 for those of you who are going along and moving up to page 71. Lewis says that if you follow his logic up to this point, that there are two ways in which this human machine can go wrong. One is when human individuals drift apart from one another. We start colliding with each other. It's kind of like bumper cars. We start bumping into each other, but it's worse than bumper cars because we do great damage to each other. And the other way that the human machine can go wrong is when we go wrong inside, not in terms of our social relations with others, but when things go wrong inside of us, when things are off balance. Lewis points out, and in one of the commentaries, the cover for this chapter is of a ship at sea, and the ship is in obvious distress. It's taking on water, it's stormy, the waves are crashing all around it. But he likens the human machine at this point to a ship at sea that is sailing with other ships in a great fleet in formation. The voyage will only be a success in the first place if the ships don't bump into each other. Ships start bumping into each other, you have a big problem on your hands. Pretty soon you don't have any ships if they bump into each other hard enough. But he also points out that if each ship is just a rusty tub with the rudder not working right and the engine not working right and the helm not working right, that fairly soon they're not going to be able to stay in formation. So he points out that we as humans, he analogizes and says that we can't live the life that we're to live in relationship to others unless we're working just the way we should inside, unless this moral law that is inside of us is well-groomed and well-maintained and this human machine is working the way it should. He then goes on, uses another analogy. He says that we're kind of like instruments in a band. We all have to play in unison. We can't work against each other in terms of how the instruments work. I can't be playing one tune, John's playing another. But also the individual instruments must be well tuned. If you play trumpet like I did, those keys have to be oiled. The machine itself, that is us, has to be properly maintained. He points out also that there are two ways that we as humans can go wrong. One, as I've said, is how we relate to others. The other is how we're doing inside. But the third way that we go wrong is, are we all moving, we being Christians, all moving in the direction that we should be going? What is the purpose of this exercise that we call life, that we call our existence? Are we all headed in the direction we should be? Going back to his analogy of the ship, he says that it's wonderful if the ships keep the right distance from each other. It's wonderful if they're all shipshape and clean, and the boilers are clean, and they have plenty of fuel. But if the ship is supposed to be sailing with its other ships, pardon me for that, that was really, really terrible. But if the ships are really supposed to be sailing together, and they're supposed to be sailing to New York, and they wind up in Calcutta, then you do have a problem. And so that's really the third part of morality, is that we're moving in the correct direction that God would have us play. So in summarizing, he points out that morality really comes in three parts. First, what he calls fair play and harmony between individuals, getting along with each other, treating each other correctly, the golden rule. The third is what he calls tidying up. Remember, he's British, so he uses a lot of British expressions here. But tidying up within ourselves, cleaning up our own house. And then third, the third aspect of morality is the purpose of human life as a whole. Why are we here? What is the end game here? What is our destiny? What is our purpose? Covers quite a bit of ground in this chapter, but he points out that out of these three parts of morality, what part do we think about the most? What obsesses us the most? He says it's that first part, how we treat each other. We don't really like talking about what's going on inside. That is way too inconvenient, way too close to home. But he says that this is really the case for several reasons. First, it's very easy to tell when we're not treating each other right. Unfairness, poverty, war, hunger, disease, plague, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. I mean, however you want to view it, that's really easy to spot. He also says that another thing that is true of problems with this first part of morality, how we treat each other, is that it's something that most people agree on. I mean, there are very few people out there who say, well, you know, I like war. Well, I don't like war. Or, well, I like disease and plague. Well, I don't like disease and plague. No one really thinks that. There's a general consensus on what is acceptable. So most of the time, we only focus on this first part of morality, and we don't get beyond it, and we don't like going beyond it. Today's Father's Day, I was thinking about my dad, and I know that when I used to come home from church, he and I had, you know, we'd talk about the sermon, and some of you have heard this, but he would ask me, what did the preacher preach on? And I would say, sin. And he'd say, well, what do you say about it? I said, he's against it. And so that's the easy part. And I could tell you the rest of that little dialogue, too, at some point. But it's probably more than you want to know, or as my wife says, too much information. But at any rate, he says that first part is where we usually park it. And that unless we go on to that second part of tidying up what is inside of ourselves, that we're really only deceiving ourselves. He says that everybody wants to make the system work better. Everybody wants to improve society. But as he's closing this first chapter, he says, you cannot make men good by law. And without good men, you cannot have a good society. That is why we must go on to think of the second thing, of morality inside the individual. In other words, it may look pretty on the outside, society may, but unless we're dealing with what's going on inside of us, that you can't really have something good result from something bad inside of us, just as a matter of logic. He finally, in closing, turns to the example. And you may remember in the first chapter, he dealt with the moral relativist. And in all of these chapters, he sort of picks out some convention of human thinking, and he deals with it. So here, he brings up the man who says that a thing cannot be wrong unless it hurts other human beings. How many of you have heard that? It's my business. That's a very, very common view. Right now. It seems that I hear about it a lot. See it in my courtroom a lot. A lot of people who have that view tend to wind up in courtrooms. And so would you agree with that, Mr. Martin? Yeah, Mr. Martin would agree with that as well. So at any rate, to put another way, does it not make any difference whether I am, so to speak, the landlord of my own body and my own mind, or only a tenant responsible to the real landlord? So he says that that way of thinking, that morality doesn't really make any difference if you're the only person hurt by your actions, is really fallacious, because for starters, there are no situations like that. Someone else is always going to be hurt by your actions. But also, you're not the real landlord. Somebody else is the real landlord, and that is God. So you have this near-term consequence of ignoring morality. He also points out a long-term consequence of ignoring morality. And this is something I had never really thought about, and I was thinking about it some more this morning. Christianity asserts that we have immortal souls, that we are going to live forever. That is a central teaching of Christianity, that Jesus paved the way for us to have immortal souls and live forever. And you really live in one of two places after you are no longer on this earth. So he points out that it really wouldn't matter. Morality really would not matter if you were a short-termer. If you thought you were only talking about an average human lifespan of 77 years or 78 years, 79 years, whatever it is now for women, men tend to live a little shorter than women, but whatever that average lifespan is, if that's all there is, then morality doesn't matter very much. But if suddenly our moral decisions and our moral thinkings have eternal consequences, then you're dealing with a totally different creature at that point, and you're dealing with totally different implications at that point. And he takes it in the negative. If you're virtuous and you're cultivating virtue, then presumably that's going to have positive effects. But if you go a million years out and you have someone who's ignored morality, maybe they've cultivated jealousy, maybe they've cultivated envy, maybe they've cultivated that great sin of pridefulness. He said that's why you wind up with hell. Goes on for millennia. For centuries of no one worrying about this natural law, of no one worrying about what's right and wrong. And so at any rate, he closes chapter one in an interesting way. He looks around him and he points out that we have essentially two ways of organizing humanity. And one is the government-centered way, which we generally call totalitarianism. The other is the individual-centered way, which is what we in the Western world subscribe to and what we aspire to, that society is not organized around the needs of government, that it's organized around individuals, and that generally you promote more and more liberty and more people over time benefit the most. And that's one of the organizing principles of the United States that we got from the British. But he says that if morality is a short-term proposition, if how we live our lives only matters for the average lifespan, then suddenly a government that's expected to live 1,000 years, like how Hitler said his Reich would be, suddenly that's what matters a whole lot more than individuals. On the other hand, if you believe that the government that's going to last 1,000 years is the short-termer, and that soul that is immortal is going to last forever, then suddenly the government as a model for organizing society sort of falls off in importance and diminishes in importance. And the Christian view, which is the individual matters more than the collective, at that point, that assumes greater prominence and becomes more and more important. So at any rate, it's a great chapter. I would encourage you to read through it. And at this point, I'll hand the baton over to John.
One of the things that got me in trouble growing up the most was not a clean room. I mean, come on, really. I don't want to single this person out because many of you folks know her, but she would tell me all the time, John, there's no sense in making my bed because it took me all night just to get it the way I like it. Why would I want to mess it up? And one of the things that makes my wife and me a little anxious, and if I was able to look at myself from a third point of view, would be the what I would see the concern about if someone's approaching our house that we didn't know that, you know, we know them, but oh my goodness, we better tidy up, right? I mean, we do that. We want to clean up, move the shoes away from the front of the door. And that second part of morality is where we fall in chapter 8, or where I'm at in, yeah, chapter 8, is this tidying up that going on, it's going on in the inside. And one of the characteristics about this particular part of tidying up is he calls this a vice, but he says everyone has this vice, but everyone loathes it in others. And Lewis has never heard anyone who was not a Christian accuse himself of having this vice. No fault makes a person more unpopular, and yet there is no fault of which we are more unconscious of. And the more we are guilty of this, the more we hate it in others. And what is that? That is the vice of pride or self-conceit. And the opposite virtue, as he continues to write in this Christian morals, is called humility. Timothy Keller preached a sermon probably about 10, 12, 13 years ago, talking about pride, talking about Nebuchadnezzar, and one of the things that he says, and I've never been able to get this out of my mind, because really, I wish I could, pride is cosmic plagiarism. Pride is cosmic plagiarism. I mean, when Wayne does this in the choir, does this wonderful piece, Wayne does not turn around and say, thank you, I wrote that. We know that was Beethoven, or we know that was so-and-so because we printed it. He does not, that would be taking credit for it. It's cosmic plagiarism. And I love where he goes on, and C.S. Lewis goes on, because if you read the chapter, wink, wink, if you read the chapter, this should have jumped off the page at you. Unchastity, greed, anger, drunkenness are all mere flea bites in comparison. Okay, think of the vice. Think of that thing in somebody else that you wish they would tidy up. Go ahead, don't tell anybody. Don't nudge someone. Don't look at anybody, okay? Just think of the thing that drives you nuts and crazy about somebody else. That is a mere flea bite in comparison. It was through pride that the devil became the devil. Pride that leads to every other vice. It is the complete anti-God state of mind. All the other vices are flea bites. I wonder if he was like watching his dog or Scratch when he came up with that illustration, that metaphor. This is the sin of Satan. According to Augustine, that was the root of all sins. The question is, though, what is so bad about pride? And if you remember in the chapter, one of the things that he wrote is I want you to get something clear. And this is what I want you to get clear about pride. That pride is essentially competitive. Is competitive by its very nature. While the other vices are competitive only, so to speak, by accident. This vice is competitive by nature. Pride gets no pleasure out of having something. Only it gets pleasure if it's having more than somebody else. Pride is the comparison that makes you feel pride, the pleasure of being above the rest. And once the element of competition is gone, pride is gone too. That is why that he says that pride is essentially competitive in the way that other vices are not. He continues, pride is competitive by its very nature, and that's why it goes on and on and on. He says, if I am a proud man, then as long as there is one man in the world more powerful, more wealthy, more cleverer than I, he will be forever my rival and my enemy. It goes on and on and on and on. It is this pride that has been the chief cause of misery in every nation, every family since the world began. But pride always means enmity. It is enmity, and not only enmity between myself and the person who might have more, but it's enmity between me and God. He continues and writes here. He says, a proud man is always looking down on things and people. And of course, as long as you are looking down, you cannot see anything above you. Time out. Who is the person that you think of when you think of pride? What is inside ourselves? Pride is that thing that is driving us to think that I don't have pride. I know I have a problem with pride. You know why? Look, I'll edit this out of the tape later on, but let's just keep us with between us. I want to be like so-and-so that preaches, or that person. I put so much value on, now did I do that exactly right? And all, listen, I'm telling you, I compare myself with everybody when it comes to teaching or preaching or whatnot. That's pride. You know what that does? Look, you know this is the truth, but let me just bear something here. You know what happens inside of me afterwards? If I don't feel good about my sermon or lesson, I can't function for about 30, 45 minutes or an hour. Sometimes even longer. That's not, let alone what anybody else might say. And if I get home and look, if I get home and Lisa doesn't say good sermon, I mean, I don't care if she's just lying. If she doesn't say it, I'm like a puppy. Hey, how was my sermon? How was my sermon? What did you think? What did you think? You know this is true inside of us. It's horrible because it causes me to be competitive. Now there's in some, as he'll share with us at the end, there's some places that this doesn't, you know, reach. I mean, that It's okay to be a little competitive and a little, have a little pride or whatnot, but when we are putting ourselves at competition, in competition, with something or someone above us, and we have pride. I mean, our pride is in serious rival with everyone else's pride. And if you don't think that there is a rivalry, you don't understand your hatred for somebody else's pride, what that means. See, the real pleasure of pride is not having something, but in having more of it than another. And this raises a terrible question. How is it that people who are quite obviously eaten up with pride can say they believe in God and appear to themselves very religious? How is it? He says, I'm afraid it means that they are worshiping an imaginary God. That they theoretically admit to themselves to be nothing in the presence of this phantom God, but are really all the time imagining how he approves of them and thinks them far better than ordinary people. That they pay a penny worth, these are his words, a penny worth of imaginary humility to him to get a pound's worth of pride to other people. And he continues, I suppose it was of those people Christ was thinking when he said that some would preach about him and cast out demons and preach in his name and all these things. And he said that they would never, that he did not know them, just in case you wanted to see it. It is in Matthew chapter 7. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but those who do the will of my Father who is in heaven. Because on that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, cast out demons in your name, do mighty works in your name? And I will say to them, and I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of wickedness. You see, whenever we find our religious life is making us feel that we are good, above all that we are better than someone else, I think we may be sure that we are being acted upon. Not by God, but by the devil. And it says a real test of being in the presence of God is that you either forget about yourself altogether or you think of yourself as a small, dirty object. It is better to forget about yourself altogether or think of yourself as a small, dirty object. It's been smuggled in. And it's become a part, this pride has become a part of our own lives. It is at the center of who we are, and it becomes the center of a religious life. Now think about this. I mean, one of the things that kind of drive us to having credibility with people, other people, it doesn't matter who they are, is they owe you. You know, you've done something for them, and you have done them a favor, you've given them a good word or a recommendation, and now they owe you, okay? We hold that in pride over that person. They owe us on that. We do this with our relationship with God, thinking that, well, I was in the C.S. Lewis study. That ought to give me some points of value in God's ledger. I prayed this week. I gave this week. I served here, there, or there. I even casted out a demon in his name. Y'all chuckling. So I think I have some credibility that I could get this from God. Do you see what it is? You're trying to manipulate God because he's more powerful. Yeah, we won't deny that. But if I can scratch his back, he'll scratch mine. And I'm going to tell you, it would be so much easier for preachers if we had a formula. If if God would have written in the book, you know, for us, the preacher's book, not that's distributed to y'all, because we still need to be needed, right? It's our pride here. All right, so it was a joke. You can laugh, all right? Look through the book. Okay, someone says, I need my child to get a good grade on a test. Look at the index test, child, good grade. Here, pray 20 minutes. Wouldn't that be great? Because we could say, well, if I prayed 21 minutes, that'd be better than expected, and maybe I'll get more from God. You know, I'll bank that extra minute. It's just spiritual pride. It goes on and on and on and on, and it's become smuggled in. Lewis wants to guard against the possible misunderstandings here. Of his pride and different things that are going on around us when it comes to this pride. But I'm going to leave those to you. You can read over again yourself. One example was for, and I'll just kind of, I want my children to take pride in their chores. Now, is that wrong? No, I want them to be pleased with themselves, what they have done. I want them to say, I did my best, and I want them to feel a sense of accomplishment, not based on making them higher or feeling lower, making someone else feel lower than somebody else, but to feel a sense of accomplishment that you've done. You can have that kind of pride, but you can kind of go in and see what he writes here. He says, it'll kind of bring us down to the conclusion. He says, we must not think that God forbids pride, being offended at it, or wants humility because he himself is pride. No, the point is that he wants us to know him. He wants us to give, he wants to give himself to us. And God is such that to get in touch with him, we have to be delightedly humble. And I love how he ends this. And I've already said all this, I think. If anyone would like to acquire humility, I can, I think, tell him the first step. The first step is to realize that one is proud. And a biggish step too, at least. Nothing, whatever, can be done before it. First thing to do this tidying up is to admit you have it and identify what it is that you're in competition with. If you think you are not conceited, it means you're conceited indeed. So, there is a sense of us giving ourselves to take a very first step, a big one, realizing that we are, in fact, proud. And we battle. Now, I have cleverly allowed time to unfortunately run out, so there's no room or time for questions. However, if you do have a question or a comment, feel free to jot it down on some of these cards over here, and we'll address those in due time. But as we go from this place, let's pray. Gracious Heavenly Father, continue to move within, without, all around us. And remind us, O God, that even though we think of ourselves as being nothing, you, O God, thought it worth everything, that we are worth everything when it came to giving your Son to die for us on the cross. Frankly, O God, I'd rather be nothing in my own eyes and everything in yours. and to have everything in my eyes and nothing in yours. So may it be for us.